Okay, maybe we can begin with where and when you were born.
So I was born at the Fort Qu'Appelle in Saskatchewan on the 21st of April, 1919.
And was there a family military background?
No, I don't believe so. I think, my dad, I think, one time had wanted to go into the Navy, but hadn't made it physically, so he came out to farm in Saskatchewan.
And when did you decide to join?
I decided, just my last year at school, 38.
And you saw an ad in the paper?
Yes, Dad was an old Englishman, of course, and he used to get the Times newspaper, and there was an ad appeared in that. The Fleet Air Arm pilots, the Royal Navy had just taken back the Fleet Air Arm from the RAF, and they were looking for pilots at that time. They were looking for people finishing school who would become pilots or observers or air crew.
And what was it about that that made you go overseas to join? The excitement?
Well, I think really there was two things. The jobs were very scarce in Saskatchewan at that time. It was during the Depression. And it also appeared that the war was in the offing. If they were going to Czechoslovakia or Europe.
You didn't want to be left out?
No, I think most of us our age group realized it was coming and thought, well, we may as well go that direction as trying to find jobs somewhere else. And I'd been interested in flying and also the Navy, so I thought here's a good opportunity.
And you just waited to receive an answer from them? Or did you have to go over?
No, I waited to receive an answer and they then said, come over and we'll have an interview.
Were there any specific qualifications?
Well, senior matric.
Senior matric.
And physically fit. So I had a medical for a phone from the family doctor. He said I should be able to make it.
And they said they wanted you?
Yes, I had an interview with the Admiralty practically soon after I got there. And I was accepted as a pilot.
And from there?
From there we went to HMS Courageous, an aircraft carrier, for it was supposed to be 6 months naval training, and then I think as the war looked to be coming up more quickly than they had expected, it was reduced to 3 months, and we had 3 months, 6 weeks, I guess, in Courageous, and she was wanted for active, or wanted to get back into the fleet, and we were sent to another aircraft carrier, a small one, in Plymouth. Hermes.
What sort of training were you doing?
Getting us started into the Navy. Most of us had never seen the Navy to be in. So we had naval training and also navigational training, seamanship and that kind of thing.
Was it a multinational force?
Mainly English.
Mostly British?
People, yes, but there were a few Australians, and a couple of New Zealanders, and a couple of South Africans, and I think 3 Canadians on it.
We were on the Hermes?
We were in the Hermes for about 3 weeks again, and then we finished our naval training and went to Greenwich College, which is really just a boarding house for us, because we took up ab initio flying training at Gravesend Little Airfield, 2 miles away. Went out to the airfield each morning in buses and did our flying training and came back to the Greenwich College at night.
What was the training like?
Flying training? I guess really just the same pretty well as it is today, to just a civilian training airfield and civilian instructors up to ab initio training. You went solo at that stage once you were solo on Tiger Moths. Had a few hours after that.
Tiger Moths or what you were training on?
Tiger Moths, yeah.
What were they like?
Oh, they were beautiful.
Were they biplanes or monoplanes?
Biplanes. With an instructor who sat behind, and single engine, of course. little bigger than an ultralight.
What was life like in England?
Oh, it was very pleasant in those days. In the Greenwich Naval College, life was very pleasant. Excellent meals, nice quarters. Our instructors at the airfield had all been retired short service commissioned Air Force officers.
And where did you go after you had done the solo?
From there we went to an RAF training station to get us up to wing standard, where we changed the wings. I think that was about a 6 month course.
And after that?
And then from there, once we'd obtained our wings, I went down to Swordfish on a torpedo attack aircraft. Then we went down to an RAF station at Gosport for training at dropping torpedoes.
The Swordfish were dive bombers?
No, that was a torpedo. Torpedo dropping aircraft, which in effect was dive bombing because they came down from about 10,000 feet and pulled out. You had to drop a torpedo. You had to be very straight and level to drop your torpedo so that it dropped into the water. You dropped it from about 50 feet and then it would run straight. If you had your nose down a bit, it might just dive right into the old sea and keep going. Or you could break its back if you were too high too, so it's a bit of a tricky operation.
What time frame are we in here now? Is it 39? It's around Christmas?
Yes, this would be the fall of 39. We just finished getting our wings when war started in September of 39. This went on until be about December of 39.
And then after that you went to southern France?
After that we went into the Mediterranean we went up to Scotland to do deck landing training, and they had a little airfield, just a grass airfield that they had a deck laid out, mm-hmm. and you practiced landing on that. And they also had a shore-based catapult organized up there, which they filled full of cordite and put you on this catapult to get you used to being catapulted up. Shot you in the sky.
What was your first time on that bike?
Well, you braced everything. You went off with a terrific force, of course, being cordite. It was like being fired out of a gun. And most of us, until we got used to it, blacked out when you got to about 300 feet. You had a little thing above the wings, the main plane on the Swordfish, that you could tighten up all your controls so that when you were fired off, the controls were all tight and were in it. Position that gave you a little bit of climb, and then when you got to a couple hundred feet, you sort of shook your head and got rid of the wooziness and undid the controls and took over from there.
And when did you first do the deck training on a carrier?
I would say it would be about January 4th, I guess, in the Mediterranean.
Aboard the
Argus, the aircraft carrier, stationed down off Toulon and Marseille, down in that area.
And that was completely training?
Once we'd done our deck landings, then we completed training. Yeah.
And from there you went
from
to
there,
Aldergrove?
I went back to Aldergrove to train air gunners and Swordfish. And there were sharks and skewers, which we used to fly to train.
What type of plane was the skewer?
The skewer was a monoplane, and it had one, Swordfish had three, had a navigator and an air gunner and a pilot, and the skewer just had a pilot and an air gunner, who had a little Lewis gun at the back.
And had a large glass?
It did, it had a large glass cockpit for the pilot, which gave you a good vision of the deck when you're coming. It also had a long nose. And when you're in a deck landing position with your tail down and your nose up, it's very difficult to see the deck, and it's hard. You peer over a bit. The large glass house gave you quite a view of the deck.
And training in the skewer made you a candidate for the Norwegian War eventually, didn't it?
Yes, I was really basically flying Swordfish there, but I had flown this thing, the skewer, and the Admiralty. Home down one night, they were short running for the pilots in the Norwegian campaign as soon as it opened there. I guess they wanted additional pilots. And two of us could fly these skewers, so we went off to do a short fighter course.
Where was that at?
That was down at Eastleigh, not just outside of Southampton. And we flew skewers and a little thing called a Gloucester Gladiator, a little biplane. And it had been one of the RAF top fighters up to that time. It had two guns, one on each side of the cockpit, and it shot through the propeller, which is a wooden propeller. Like I mentioned to you occasionally, this thing got a bit out of whack and he shot a few bullets through the propeller, but it just made holes.
What would that do?
A nice little round hole, and it didn't affect the flying ability at all, except the poor old maintenance man had to change the propeller when he came back.
Yeah. So we're in early 1940 now, or would it be spring?
It should be about April 1940.
And you were moved?
From that, after a couple of weeks, I was moved up to the Hatston at the Orkneys. We just had a couple of days there waiting for the ARC. Flew off and I joined the AGO 3 squad.
And where were you serving?
Well,
for the ARC.
From there we were off the Norwegian coast. At that stage, the British had landed an expeditionary force in Norway. And at that stage they were starting to evacuate and they were retreating back up to Narvik and back up the north coast. So the Ark Royal was giving fighter cover to the to the army as best they could. And, they moved back.
Covering the evacuation?
Well, eventually we got back, covered the evacuation around Narvik. They moved them out from the shore to freighters, merchant ships, and destroyers, and we covered the shore position.
Do you remember how you felt the first time you saw action?
Well, there's always a bit of excitement to it. I think the first time I saw action was we had a bombing attack on the Ark Royal by Heinkels, and three of us were up covering my feet. And I saw a poor old Heinkel ditch in the ocean and shot down, and the guys got out and waved to you, and you felt, well, for the grace of God, there goes I. And of course, I guess they all dropped, because when we got back, we reported it, but they said, oh, we're too busy to try and pick up like that.
What was a typical day in the life aboard the ARC for the flyers?
Well, we were flying, it was in May, June, and daylight up all the time. You could read a newspaper on the flight deck at the middle of the night. So we had a 24-hour operation going on. And really, I began wondering after a while, you got a bit weary. We'd go off on perhaps a 4-hour patrol or a 3-hour patrol. And it seemed to me you had very little rest in between, perhaps 5 or 6 hours. And then with things happening on the ship, the noise of the ship, we didn't really get a lot of sleep. But after a week or so, everyone, including the maintenance man and the aircraft handlers on the deck and the air crew, they'd get a bit pooped and they'd head off into what they used to call the long grass way up past the end of Norway, where they hoped that nobody would see the carrier. Enemy aircraft wouldn't find it. And they'd just lay off for a couple of days and rest as they would leave them. Head back and start again.
Was there much of a defense on the part of the Germans?
The Germans had quite a few aircraft there at times, and we were fairly fortunate at that time because they'd had some hurricanes up in Narvik. A squadron of hurricanes, about 12 hurricanes. And I think when they saw these skewers coming, they used to think they were hurricanes, and they quite often split up and head back for home. Helped a lot.
The hurricane was more intimidating than...
The hurricane was much faster. Okay. Yeah, it had more guns. It's kind of thinner. And I think they learned the lesson. Dealing with the hurricane. The slow old bomber, Heinkel 111, was pretty slow.
Yeah. Okay. When was the attack on Trondheim Harbor?
That was the we covered the evacuation. We had Glorious, an aircraft carrier, with us as well, and she landed on the remaining Hurricanes, about 6 Hurricanes, and had permission to go directly back to UK around the Narvik area. And the Ark Royal stayed with the convoy to provide fighter protection of that. But en route back, the Glorious ran into the Scharnhorst and Eisenhower and a couple of destroyers. And Glorious had 2 destroyers with her, and they were all sunk. Glorious, very few survived that. But when we got the convoy back to off the Orkneys, Scotland, and then we went back to try and find the Scharnhorst to attack her. And she had gone into Trondheim Harbor. So we, the skewers, were sent into Trondheim Harbor to dive bomb her.
Were 2 squadrons going in?
Yeah, they weren't 2 complete squadrons. At that time, I forget, we had a total of about 15 aircraft left from both squadrons. And I think there were 17 aircraft. 2 stayed back for fighter protection over the Ark in case they thought that the bombers might follow any of the survivors back out to an attack. So 2 skewers stayed back there for fighter cover of the Ark. And then 15 skewers went in. We did a landfall on a lighthouse just north of Trondheim, and then we were going to head south into Trondheim, but we had a report that the lighthouse was on the watch. It was watched, and they had all the fighters up by the time we got to the area, Trondheim area, so we started getting pretty heavy losses from fighters. And those that survived the fighter attacks went in and did dive bombing, and of course with the all the ships in harbor and the shore batteries putting up a cone of fire above the Scharnhorst, to seem to know we were going for her. It was pretty difficult to get through and attack and survive.
Was the Scharnhorst hit at all?
Yeah, I think there was one bomb, and it didn't explode.
And there was 3 planes that
I think there was
made
about,
it back?
About 3 or 4 that made it back, yes.
And
they had expected some pretty heavy losses on the thing, but they thought that it would be worth it. I suppose if the ship had been damaged, it would have been worth it, because it would have stayed in harbor if it had been sunk. Because it was a great threat to the whole of the northern... all the northern oceans, and if it had got out, of course, whatever is keen with shipping going to Britain. So.
Do you remember much about when you were hit, your plane was hit?
Well, a fair bit, yes. I think we were first hit by fighters while we were, my air gunner is very good. He took his parachute off. He had a chest parachute at the fire of the Lewis gun. He kept heavy. Shoot off. He thought he could get a more accurate bead on these poor things, on these things. But they had cannon coming in on this, and also their .5s. And he had these little Lewis guns. He told me he thought he'd got one, but we were hit pretty badly. We got one cannon shell in our a fuel tank just behind me. Fortunately, it was still full. I hadn't turned it on, and that of course. Spilt fuel all over everywhere. Mm-hmm. And then I got a couple of bullets in my side. I can feel all the blood running down. We were quite glad to get out of the fighters and into the flak. And then, of course, once you're in the flak, you thought, gosh, I'd rather be back in the fighters. But we could see, as we did our diving attack, we could see bits and pieces going off the aircraft. It became very sluggish.
And what happened when you crashed?
Well, we carried out the attack and came down over the over the harbor and then headed for the rooftops of Trondheim, about 50 feet, low level type of thing, and I thought, well, they won't fire there. And we found more machine guns on the rooftops, and I think they put a few more bullets into the aircraft. We got just south of town, and the engine was running very roughly, and the whole thing was shaking away. And this aircraft suddenly seemed to stand on its tail, and then drop down and hit the ground. I think an engine fell out. The engine fell out. But other engineers have said, oh, perhaps I hit a tree or something since I knocked it out. I don't know. I was fairly woozy at the time.
Yeah. And what do you remember when you were down? What happened?
Well, we... every time I stood up, I got woozy and I had to get my head down, and my air gunner hadn't been hit at all, so he started. We were only 12 miles from the Norwegian border, and he headed out for that. And I tried to burn what was left of the aircraft with a very pistol, but not much happened, but we destroyed our maps and this kind of thing. And it seemed to me it wasn't long before, there was a farmhouse not far away, and some Germans appeared with rifles. With my air gunner, who popped into some and come back. So we were both, I was pushed in it wasn't an ambulance as far as I remember, a truck or something, and taken into the hospital. My air gunner went into a prison camp.
Were you treated well in the hospital?
Yes, it was in the Norwegians were, the German doctors, the Norwegians were still running the hospital, and they treated very well.
And from there, were you taken someplace to be interrogated?
No, I was there for I guess a couple of weeks, and then moved down gradually into Germany. And by the time we got through, we were all considered flyers, so we were sent to an RAF camp, which was Dulag Luftwaffe interrogation center that all Air Force people went through. But by the time we got down there, Europe had been overrun, and the times had changed so much that they really weren't interested.
Your information?
My information was outdated. I think the only time that they'd have been really concerned with our information was where we'd come from and where the ship carrier would be, so that they could send their aircraft out to look for it and bomb it. they didn't seem to bother at all with that. I was taken to the hospital.
And you were moved fairly soon after.
We had about, I think as far as I remember, it's hard to remember the exact date and this kind of thing, but it seems to me to be early July or middle of July when we were there, and then I was only there for a couple of weeks and moved up to a camp at on the Baltic, Stalag Luft 1, with about 200 others who had just been opened up, a sandy old place with barren and sandy.
What was life like at the camp? There was only 200 people total in the camp?
Total when we opened it up, I would say about 200. Most of the Air Force people had been captured in France, the fall of France, who'd been flying battles and fighters, hurricanes, and this kind of thing. And shot down as the Germans advanced through France. Life that first summer, I think, was very trying because we had. They had no communication. They'd overrun Europe, and they had no communication through the Red Cross with the British. And we lived on about two slices of bread a day, and a small inch or two of sausage, and about a quarter inch of margarine, and some watery soup at lunchtime. Of course, we were very, very hungry that first summer also.
That was your major concern?
That was our major concern, just to survive, dream of food.
How were you treated by the guards?
At that stage, they were very strict and very harsh. For instance, we had a few Air Force, French Air Force people with us, some Polish people. And there was there was a warning wire 6 inches high, about 12 feet from the main fence running around, and you weren't allowed to step over that or you'd be shot. And one Frenchman he saw just bent down and put his hand 6 inches in the wire and picked the flower. And of course the guard just shot him. The tree thought was, you know, completely unnecessary, but I guess it let us send us a message that this is what they meant when they said that.
Did you think about escape right from the start?
Yes, I think most people did. First, with your rations the way they were, and you just wanted to get out of that place as fast as you could.
Yeah. I read by the time you were at the camp, though, that was the hardest place to escape from. The best time would be while you were traveling.
That's right, yeah. But in those days, we had no instruction on escaping or anything like this. And in my case, I was still... my wounds still needed dressing, and I wasn't in particularly good shape when they moved me out of the hospital and the camp. So, but on the whole, that's it's easier to do it then than inside camping. Except if, unless when you're initially taken, you really have no preparation. They don't give you any food to carry, and so a lot of people hope that once they got to the camp, they could get organized and get maps and compasses and find a bit more of routes and this kind of thing.
Was there much of an escape committee or organization at Stalag-Luft 1 when you were there?
It was just really starting. We had we found some people kept diaries, and they would say in their diary a tunnel had started or something like this. And of course, then the Germans would have a search and they'd find these things. So it was a very elementary thing. And this is really why we started getting organized into escape committees. And also the other big factor was that perhaps somebody was planning an escape which was going to interfere directly with somebody else's plans. So to coordinate these things, originally that was the basis of the escape committee, just to coordinate the escapes. And of course it grew.
And would the escapes have to be approved by the committee?
Yes, yeah.
And
because
was it upheld?
Yes, oh yes, yeah.
Very strict?
Yeah. We had, no discipline to an appearance, but we had an excellent discipline. Everybody was, one objective in mind, to escape yourself or help somebody else escape, and certainly to baffle the Germans at every opportunity if you could. Your discipline is all built around this morale factor.
When did you start your first tunnel?
Well, we started it really in the fall of 1940. But of course, again, not knowing very much about it, it was a sandy thing, and we hadn't realized that too. The Germans had microphones in the walls.
Of the
huts, the barracks. So, I guess they learned very quickly what was going on. And then, of course, after that, things developed where they had what we call ferrets in the compound, looking for this kind of thing.
What were the main troubles with tunneling?
Well, at this one place, the Stalag-Luft 1, it's
so
sandy. Almost impossible. And we had your bunks had boards with straw palliasses, and we used to use boards to try and shore it up. But of course, again, on a search, the Germans said that it was a good indication when the bed started having 3 or 4 boards each instead of a full complement.
And disposal of the sand.
Disposal of the sand was very tricky.
Yeah. What would you do? What sort of things?
Well, up there, it wasn't too bad because you could. As long as it wasn't wet or damp when you brought it out, there was so much sand you could try and dry it out and spread it around without being noticed. But of course the towers had, the guards had binoculars in the towers. But again we tried putting it in the early stages, putting it up on the rafters and this kind of thing. But they soon got that's a question of one person keeping one step ahead of the other side.
Yeah. So how was the tunnel eventually discovered? Was it through the microphones?
I think probably through the microphones, yes. Yeah, because they came straight in and went straight to the entrance to the thing.
Was the security good on the part of the Germans?
Yes, it was. They eventually had sound detectors outside.
Were you reprimanded, or what sort of punishment was there?
Yes, if, of course, you were caught in coming out of a tunnel or going down or something like this, it was usually a 2-week or 3-week, depending on how many times you've been in solitary confinement. But a lot of people were quite happy because it got you out of this. You had very crowded quarters, and here you had a nice little cell of yourself for a couple of weeks.
You were moved shortly after to another camp? Or
yes, we all went shortly after that.
This was just a temporary camp?
No, this was they built it as a permanent camp. I think as the war progressed, they got to get more than they expected. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they marched in one morning and read out a list of names. And we just marched through the gate and moved out.
By train?
Yes, by boxcar, 40 horses and or 40 men and 8 horses or whatever it was, and this kind of thing. Usually, sometimes, they got the third class treatment where you got wooden seats. Kind of pretty deal.
Yeah. And you were moved to Spangenberg?
We were moved to the castle, upper castle at Spangenberg, off by 9AH, where there were some other Air Force officers there. And it was, I think, really just being building up because they were holding us and getting a group together to move to Poland, a place called Thorn in Poland. At that time, I think the Canadians had some prisoners put in an underground fort at Kingston or something. The Germans were retaliating by putting that. I find it hard to remember the numbers, but I would think that probably about 250 of us all told were sent to some army, some air force, sent to the Thorn in Poland, the underground fort.
But it's been around since the time of Bismarck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Living in a dungeon almost.
Oh, it was, yes. They were dungeons. They had, some of them, they stored potatoes in. Sanitary conditions weren't very good. They had a pail bucket in the middle of the room for your nighttime needs and this kind of thing. Locked in there. But we did, they did improve conditions after we've been in there for an hour.
Were you at this time getting Red Cross?
No, we weren't. No. No, we were still on pretty strict rations. We had some orderlies there, some British orderlies, who'd been taken at Dunkirk, and I think their treatment was a bit better, being in the men and not having tried any escapes, I don't think, and they used to go outside for various jobs and things, and the Poles gave them a few additional rations, and they passed them on to us for the good and the rations they could.
There's a bit of a charade on their part that you found out about, I guess it was the first night?
Yes, the Germans were giving us a pretty hard time, telling us they'd hate to be going where we're going and all this kind of thing. And we got into this, marched into this hole in the wall in this underground fort, and we said, we'd hate to be going there too. And then the British, there was a few British orderlies there, and they were swearing at us, being officers, and giving us a hard time, this kind of thing, saying, oh, look at even the SOEs, this kind of thing, for getting us into this whole thing. And this was only in front of the Germans. As soon as they got away from the Germans, they said, play along with us because the Germans are going to make it easier for us because we think we're against the officers, but we're with you, and it'll make it easy, eventually make it easier for you. So they the first night there, we hadn't eaten for about 2 days, and they saved up their rations, and they gave us a tremendous treat, unbeknownst to the Germans.
Yes. As far as I remember, Tom, and it's sometimes difficult to get the exact times, but it seems to me we were there until the spring, or underground, and towards the end of the spring they allowed us up in the top of the fort. And one sight that I think I'll never forget, they had a bunch of, a group of Polish women and old men and children digging a trench down in front of the fort. And they had a few Germans guarding them with rifles, but they had the main person there seemed to carry a couple, few of them carried big bullwhips. And they'd go along, and you'd see the diggers speed up as the bullwhip approached, and they'd allow them out, you know, step back about 10 feet from the trench to you'd go to the toilet, this kind of thing, and they'd no sooner up their skirts or down their trousers and show a bare buttock, and the Germans would try and sneak up with them and give them a great whack of the bullwhip, and you'd hear the cries, and they'd jump back to work. And I think this was when you're young and you see, you know, you can see guys being killed and this kind of thing, but to see that unnecessarily cruelty was a thing I'll never forget. But then our conditions seemed to improve from there on. We got up on top of the fort, and you know, spring was coming, and the sun was nice, and the orderlies were still bringing in a few extra rations.
The Germans
seems to be that
still didn't realize.
They sort of got a bit more used to the orderlies, and they got a bit more used to us and this kind of thing, and it seemed to be settling down a bit more. So I think at that stage, as I remember, a few Red Cross parcels came in, which made all the difference to everybody. Yeah. But just before Germany, well, for a month or so before Germany went into Russia, we could hear the traffic going by, build up. You could see trucks moving up and hear trains just going continually, and occasionally see the train was loaded down with equipment. And I guess it was seems to me to just a few days before they invaded Russia that we were moved out and moved back to a huge camp at Warburg, which was quite far east in, or west in Germany. And on this trip, their attitude changed completely. We had water on the trip, and the guards were quite reasonable. And I have always thought that it was probably because they thought that Britain was going to make peace with them as soon as they attacked Russia and joined them in helping Russia. And also, from backs this up, my thoughts are sort of backed up with this because we had we went to a camp where there was about 3,000, and they gathered up officers from all over Germany, put them in this one huge camp. And we met a lot of the 51st Highland Division who'd been doing the rear guard action at Dunkirk. And of course they were, as a rear guard action, they were told to stand and fight, and there was no retreat for them, and so they were all captured at Dunkirk pretty well. But they were a wonderful bunch, and full of spirit.
What was this camp like, Warburg?
Warburg was a huge camp, and I've since read stories saying, oh, it was dreadful because of the mud and the sanitary conditions and this kind of thing. But I thought it was very reasonable, and we had a good spirit there. We had one barrack, and I guess there must have been about 150 Air Force officers in the barrack, and I was in that barrack with the Air Force officers. Of course, the whole camp at that stage, the Army officers were all very keen on escaping, and the Air Force officers, so the whole camp seemed to be concentrating their thoughts on escaping at that stage.
Well, what was the organization like at this point? Had it improved a great deal?
Yes, it had, yeah. And the Army are great organizers at the best of times, so they had a tremendous organization. But again, their discipline was very loose and friendly, and it was more by just respect for each other that the discipline was carried out than, you know.
And at this time, I think you tried to dig another tunnel from this camp?
Yes, there's quite a few, and of course, you didn't tell other people. You tried to keep the knowledge quiet, and so people didn't have they obviously knew,
yeah,
probably, but you didn't discuss it very much. We had a tunnel going from the Air Force block, and I guess there were other tunnels going throughout the camp, and this is why you'd have the the escape committee sort of coordinating these things so that two tunnels didn't meet in the, the center of the thing, or one didn't break just before the other one was due, and this kind of thing.
Sure.
But we this was, I guess, the winter of 42 by this time, and we'd to get air into the tunnel, the ground was frozen down, as I remember, about 3 or 4 feet, and we went down under the frost line. But to get air into the tunnel, we put board holes up through, as I remember, about an inch or so along the way. And what we didn't realize, but down there, when you were working, it was very hot and close, and you sweated quite a bit. And of course, steam came up through these little things, and we must have. We got very close to the fence on this one when some guard noticed steam coming up some of our holes, so they raided our barracks and searched the barracks and found the tunnel, and that was the end of that one.
They had no pumps, air pumps at this time?
Not at this stage, no. That was we thought we could get away without them, and we hadn't realized that the holes would make steam the way they did. With and we were making quite good progress on this one because the ground was frozen and we didn't need boards to shore it up.
Mm-hmm. How far had you gone before it was discovered?
I would think it must have been 100 feet, and we weren't far from the fence. And it seemed to me it was quite a long one.
Mm-hmm. Must have been a terrible feeling when it...
Oh yeah, you think, oh well.
Start another one.
Yeah, start another one. But when you're down there, it's sort of a frightening experience in a way. They're very close quarters, and you make it as small as you can, and you pass the earth. If you're the digger at the face, you have to slide the earth underneath you, and you work in, if you got that long underwear in the summer, you work in your nothings and then have a shower so that nobody finds you don't have dirty, muddy clothing hanging around for the Germans to see.
How wide would it have been? Just almost shoulder?
Like? Yes, just about wider than your shoulders, so that you could pass the dirt back easily, and then you had somebody behind you that shoved it back to another person. So
at this time, there was someone you thought was a German spy in the camp?
Yes, at this time, and I've forgotten the chap's name, we had a young Air Force pilot officer come in a shiny new uniform. And when they came in, when somebody was shot down and came into camp, he was sent into a room. And by the stage, we had an organization where you interrogated them, you hoped, without them knowing it. So that you could. But this chap didn't have an idea as to about the service life or squadron life or anything else. So we thought, well, the Germans have put him in to find out what's going on. And we ostracized the poor guy. And for about 3 weeks, nobody spoke to him, and we wouldn't share our food with him, and he had an awful time. He just seemed to roll off him like water off a duck's back. He just didn't care, didn't speak to anybody. But after a while, we found out that the Air Force had sent one of their experts on radar, put him on a pilot officer's uniform, a civilian, in the pilot's office while he was checking out the radar, which he'd worked on for a long time, and he was a scientist. And we got a message from the Air Force that they were very frightened that this chap had fallen in the German hands, as they hadn't heard anything about him, and he might be talking to the Germans about, under pressure, of course, about that it was H2S, their initial early radar in 42. And I was in a room we had the senior Air Force officer that time was a wing commander, and we had about 8 of us in his room because we were digging a tunnel from his room. We didn't think they'd suspect it, but and this poor guy. And so we closed down the tunnel while we interrogated her. They had a closer look at this guy to see what was happening. But once the wing commander realized who he was, then of course he got them to one side, and they'd walk outside so that nobody could hear their conversation. And this guy did admit that he knew about it. But from there on, we had electrical supplies down our tunnels and lights, and he's up quite a bit. Poor chap.
At this time, the Army had quite an escape plan in the works. I looked it up. It was called Operation Olympic. What do you remember about that?
Well, as I remember, there was a fairly big gymnasium or recreation room, and of course the Army were keeping this fairly secret, but they had so many involved that you know, a lot of people knew about it, and they had built three long ladders, just a bit higher than the fence, and then at the end of the ladder there was a projection which one could jump out and grab and swing, and then you could clear across. It would, meant they could roll, put the ladder up against the fence, and then jump and reach the bar on the other side and swing themselves over the fence, which was about 6 or 8 feet wide. And there, somebody had noticed that there was some bare wires crossing one corner of the camp, which supplied all the perimeter power to the perimeter lights and the searchlights and the guards boxes. So they, the Army figured they could throw a piece of wire over it and fuse all the lights, and then they'd rush out to these three ladders in separate parts of the compound and have about 100 men in each lined up to go over each ladder. And of course the first ones out were the planned to be German speakers, so they would, once they got out the other side of the fence, they'd call out, "Don't shoot in," or "Don't shoot this direction," and "Don't shoot at all," and confuse the whole issue. I wasn't there when they did get it going. I wasn't there at the time, but I heard later that I think about 100 got out or something like that. But, you know, and I guess it was quite a shamazzle. So German shouting and British shouting in German.
And you had your own escape from this camp?
Yes, I was with six RAF chaps, and we were in, we'd organized a trip into cells so that we could escape from cells. The cells were just outside the camp.
The cooler?
The cooler. Yeah. And
how did you get in there? What sort of...
There was an Army chap due in for some reason or other, and I forget what he was going in for a couple of weeks. So I just took his place and went in as an Army officer. And the Air Force chaps did the same thing, that whoever was scheduled to go in there. Coolers are always full for not saluting or doing something like that. And we were we had organized it. Each afternoon they had a 2-hour walk around. You walked around the circle and the guards, and you weren't allowed to talk to each other, but we could tie up a shoelace and pass each other messages to see how it goes. But there were two sort of wings on the thing, and at night about 9 o'clock they start with one along one wing and let people out to go to the toilet, which was in the center of the two wings, and then they'd come back and lock that door and keep going down the edge. And the doors were locked with bolts from the outside in the corridor, and the light was very dim. So our plan was to one chap create a ruckus as he came in to get the guard's attention, and then from it, who was in a cell, you'd bang on the door and say, "I had to go to the toilet in a hurry," or something, and try and get the guard's attention. As soon as the guard turned, the other chap was by one of our doors, and he'd slip the bolts back quietly so that the chap inside held the door so it wouldn't swing open. And then once the guards had gone for the night, the chap whose door was open,